Hello and welcome to this, the 18th episode of the Eastern Art podcast series. My name is Phil Ward and I'm the director of the Eastern Art Consortium, which brings together the universities of East Anglia, Essex and Kent. Today we're going to be looking at the idea of natural capital. This extends the economic notion of capital to encompass the world's stock of natural resources, including its geology, soils, air, water and all living organisms. This has never been more important. With the challenges of the climate crisis, we now need to work sustainably and think differently about how we farm, how we consume, and how we manage our natural resources. But is it possible to quantify and fully understand natural capital? When we're dealing with such complex interrelationships, can we robustly assess the effect and value of the ecosystem of which we're part? With me to look at both the history and the current state of research are three experts from across Eastern Arc. Andrew Lovett is from UEA, Alex Dumbrell is from the University of Essex, and Rob Fish is from the University of Kent. I'll let each of them introduce themselves in turn.
Hello, I'm Andrew Lovett. I'm a professor of geography at the University of East Anglia in Norwich. I've particularly got a background in the use of geographical information systems, and I've worked a lot with environmental economists in looking at spatial variations in natural capital and how you can use different sorts of economic methods in conjunction with GIS to put values on natural capital. In the last few years, I've been particularly working on projects looking at the interface between renewable energy and natural capital. And I'm currently working a lot with local authorities and other stakeholders in Norfolk and Suffolk in particular to develop things like a natural capital evidence compendium and a local 25-year environment plan.
So I'm Rob Fish. I'm based in the School of Anthropology and Conservation. I'm a geographer by training. I'm very broadly interested in, you know, how we manage the natural environment as an asset for people's well-being. And I approach that from a social science starting point. I see the sort of big environmental issues of the day as sort of scientific issues wrapped up in social and political and cultural problems and conundrums. I'm always looking to put frameworks like natural capital in that social, political, cultural context.
So my name's Alex Dumbrell. I'm a professor of ecology in the School of Life Sciences at the University of Essex. My research broadly focuses on the relationship between biodiversity and ecosystem functions and processes. And linked into all of this is how we as a society, we as humanity are changing biodiversity globally and locally, and how that might then impact the flows of the services and goods that we require from it.
So all three of today's speakers have been working on natural capital for a number of years. I started by asking Rob how the concept, how the idea of natural capital had come about.
Yeah, I think it's an idea that is sort of laid on a whole series of developments over the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, natural capital is very important because it allows us to capture people's imagination, particularly policymakers, about why the natural environment is important. Natural capital was an attempt to really sort of pull back from an ecosystem services framework, which was often seen to be quite nebulous. Natural capital was almost like a retreat back into a certain kind of science where you can measure things very, very clearly and say they give rise to these benefits. So natural capital broadly for me is a term that, you know, has been a tactical term used by natural and social scientists to assert the value of the natural environment in decision making. Yeah, that's how I would put it. Maybe others see it differently.
I think to a large extent, I agree with what Rob's just said. I mean, to me, natural capital is, I mean, it's very heart, and in some of the very early natural capital papers, sort of 25 to 30 years ago now, or certainly the earliest ones that I came across, it was an attempt there to evaluate and put a number on the ecosystems and the habitats and the natural world around us. And that works really well because I think Rob's absolutely right. Ecosystem services are a rather sort of nebulous term. It's not easy to quantify an ecosystem service. And one of the big reasons with that is that a large number of ecosystem services are made up of multiple components of different ecosystem functions and processes, so the things that the ecosystems are doing. And while we can say an ecosystem recycles nutrients, that's the service it gives us, it's very difficult to fully measure that. What we can measure is the recycling of carbon, and we can do
exactly
some and nitrogen transformations and phosphorus cycles and all the rest of it, and then combined in some way that we don't quite understand is the service we get from it. Whereas if you take a step back from that and say, well, actually, there is a certain value to the natural capital behind that, then you've got a number. And if you've got a number, people understand it. Scientists understand it. Policymakers understand it. General people understand it. You can say, this area has got a bigger number than that area. And that sort of fundamentally, I think, is how the human brain works. So I think it's quite a clever sort of term in that sense, conceptualize what we're doing.
So how do we put a number on that service? How do we quantify the unquantifiable? Andrew explains the difficulty.
It certainly can be very challenging. I think we are better at addressing the values associated with some sorts of benefits from ecosystem services than others. And I think we've got better at doing some of them over time. As has been said, it's difficult in many instances because the benefit that you can perhaps put a value on, because you can relate it to a marketable commodity, like the value of a view on a property price, for instance, or the value of flood risk mitigation or so forth. The problem in many cases is that there's multiple ecosystem functions and multiple habitats or land uses that are all interacting to ultimately generate that flow of benefits. So that's your challenge. I would say that we are better at valuing some of the benefits that have got a closer connection to market goods and services. So to use a little bit of jargon, there's a distinction made between provisioning ecosystem services, which would be things like food and fiber, regulating ecosystem services, which would be things like carbon sequestration, and cultural ecosystem services, which would be something like the value of a view. The methods tend to be better at some aspects of provisioning services, some aspects of regulation, like, for example, carbon sequestration, and many aspects of cultural ecosystem services are much more challenging. There are aspects like recreation value, where people have developed methods to do that, where you can try and estimate the value of a recreational resource based on the number of people who are willing to visit it. But there's a very definite spectrum of our ability to value natural capital.
Rob's been involved in a NERC-funded program called Valuing Nature. His particular area, his particular stream was the social sciences and humanities part of the program. How did the program manage that task of quantifying the more intangible or perhaps the services that were further from market and harder for us to understand?
Yes, so I think if you think about the sort of the evolution of that debate and where value in nature sat in it and arts humanities, it's like there's a number of revolutions that have gone on. You know, firstly, the sort of natural scientists started speaking to the economists because they thought they could solve the problems if they got with the economists. And broadly, social science is a sort of the second revolution in these sorts. It was like a broadening out of the social science when we realized actually the economics, well, you know, when a decision about investing in a new infrastructure is going to hit on a minister's table, what do? They look at the cost-benefit analysis and they appeal to instinct. The cost-benefit says this, but we've actually, public sentiment won't go that way. You realize there was inadequacies in the sense the disciplinary knowledge of these processes, however much you could sort of count things or use analytical processes. And so the second revolution was a broadening of the social sciences, and people like me started arriving and talked about participation and participatory government, because it's often about the marriage of analytical processes with deliberative things and visualizing how landscapes change. And so this was the second revolution, and then the third revolution was that the social scientists were almost like they really got behind this, these kind of analytical deliberative approaches. But it was also based on a sort of misconception about what these services were. And in a sense, they're often, you've got to think of these sort of ecosystems, so natural capital, as kind of cultural contracts. There's a very interpretive dimension to understand the landscape and understand how landscape changed, the time profound processes that are going on around us and what makes certain forms of development acceptable or not. And that was a great opportunity for the arts and humanities to in a sense, instigate the third revolution, which was like an interpretive revolution, which is actually putting you know, a lot of these things in context. And what really, really happened, this is why I'm going to be really political, Phil, if you understand the story, is the value in nature really opened up to the arts and humanity, and it got very nebulous as a result. It got very slippery, and that's why natural capital emerged, because it became something you could control and measure and invest in the science. Because in many respects, what happened with these revolutions was it became more and more qualitative, it got more and more political. I think the Value in Nature program has been something which has broadened out that community, but also led to re-entrenchment of a certain kind of model in science.
So there's a sense of a pendulum swing between widening out the concept of natural capital and then re-entrenching in a more scientific understanding. I was interested to see what the scientists on the panel today thought of that. I turn to Alex.
So, I mean, this is probably not what you want to hear in terms of a discussive podcast, but I can't counter his argument. So I started working on looking at how you might try and link biodiversity and ecosystem services or so at something about 10 years ago. I guess I really started to take a really big interest in it. And it became very clear very quickly that it is almost impossible to establish quantitatively a link between biodiversity and ecosystems, the flows of ecosystem services and their delivery to us. And in that 10 years that I've been looking at this, we've managed to do a very good job of linking biodiversity and biodiversity change to ecosystem functions and ecosystem processes. We've got a clearer understanding that it's the network of interactions within a community, as opposed to necessarily the individual nodes within that community, the individual species themselves that drive the functions and the processes. But we are nowhere nearer now than we were 10 years ago of making that direct link to biodiversity, to ecosystem services, those functions and processes in the middle. We know there is a link, but that's about it. So everything Rob said rings true with me. It's unbelievably difficult to do to make that direct link to serve the flows of services and goods and services. And that's because, you know, you pick up on the stuff that Andrew said. First of all, they are very different units of currency. It's a different unit of currency measuring how somebody feels about the environment culturally to how much food you can eat from a given plot of land, you know, it's crudest, or how much timber it produces, or how much pasture land it gives you. You know, it's very different units of currency for measuring those data. And then, of course, you're getting into the concept here as well, which is it only really becomes an ecosystem service when it's got demonstrable benefit to humanity. You know, I can measure the ability of an ecosystem to recycle, but how do I then put a value on how much that ability of recycling benefits humanity? This becomes another nebulous connection in there. So I'm actually very much with what Rob said. This step back to somewhat older terminology, but somewhat more sensible terminology that has allowed us to overcome some of the issues with opening the conversation to the point where it's so wide that you've got more voices and multiple disciplines speaking in it that themselves aren't very good at communicating between because they work in very different ways. And actually taking it back to a simpler approach really works from the point of view of understanding. So, yeah, I'm sorry, that's not necessarily the greatest discussion in a podcast where you might want us facing off against each other or anything. I'm sort of largely in agreement with what Rob said.
So there's clear consensus between Rob and Alex. Was it the same with Andrew?
Well, I certainly recognise what Rob is describing. I am a quantitative person by background. I'm not going to pretend I'm not, because I am. I do think it depends a lot on the question that you're trying to answer. And I think in a lot of cases, it depends a great deal on the geographical scales at which you want to try and address things. I can entirely understand the challenges of trying to look at things on very local scales, where basically the cultural and the societal elements become extremely important. I do still feel very strongly that there is a value in the quantitative assessments, especially when you're trying to look at issues on a broader geographical scale. And I'm personally very struck by how those techniques, the academic debates may have moved in one direction. I would argue that some of the implementation by governments and agencies in particular has moved in a different direction. So there's a tension there as well.
So what's the difference between the drivers of the academic research and the policymakers who are implementing the findings of it?
Well, for instance, at the moment, the UK agricultural and land use policy is undergoing an enormous change because of Brexit and the fact that we've left the common agricultural policy. The system of single farm payments, you know, direct payments for owning land is basically being phased out. New agri-environmental schemes are going to be introduced, phased in over the next 6 years or so. They are putting much more emphasis on, to use the phrase, public money for public goods. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, there is much more emphasis within government departments like DEFRA at the moment in thinking, okay, how can we value these different benefits and services and use those to design a scheme that farmers and land managers can actually implement? That's one example. Another example would be in the area of net zero. When you're looking at future uses of land and you're trading off things to do with food production, renewable energy production, and all the other different sorts of things that you could use land for.
With the increased external emphasis and opportunity on natural capital, it feels that a lot of people are coming into the area. They see the chance to put in place systems of assessment that aren't perhaps as robust as they should be. Is that a fair assessment?
I didn't know. I mean, I would just say this as a sort of, I'll give it back as a sort of seminar discussion. These frameworks have the sort of the hidden ambition, the dream, if not, of harmonizing diverse areas of resource management into, you know, frameworks that, you know, monitor things over time in standardized ways. And, you know, I think that's fine to stylize that at a sort of national level, indeed international level, you know, where you're just looking at the sort of the curve gradually and where, what policies we need. But if you're trying to create frameworks which are trying to, you're trying to imply you can create frameworks that absorb all this stuff, the more information you put in, the less meaning you get. You know, so we run the risk of creating a world of more and more information, less and less meaning, in a sense, with these frameworks. And but having said that, you know, one of the reasons why I'm in discussion, because you could argue that I'm painting myself out of the box here. I mean, the reason why I continue to participate in these discussions is because I think there is something in this, these kind of frameworks, if we keep our ambitions in check. There's particular areas of resource management, these things work really well. If you're trying to go back, there's an all-encompassing public goods model where you can sort of plug in numbers and work out all the trade-offs. I feel this is a sort of a scientific dream based on sort of poor reasoning from first principles, really. And the more you try to create these standardized frameworks, which are all encompassing, the more you pour into them, the less you might actually understand. I stay in the discussion because I think they're really interesting. I like the idea of harmonization. It creates some good areas in proven resource management contexts. And I think agriculture is a good venue for some of that.
My sort of feeling for any of the frameworks that we try and put in place is ultimately that just that a framework. So things need to be simple enough that they can actually be operationalized. And that's where you run a very like narrow line, if you like, between tipping below, trying to understand everything and really get your head around all of it and delving into a problem ad infinitum and not actually getting anything done. And there is a balancing act to be had there. We are dealing with natural systems. There's complex systems, and complex systems, by their very nature, have emergent properties that are unpredictable. And I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where we fully get that. Biodiversity is scale dependent. Change in biodiversity is scale dependent. You can have two habitats, A and B. You measure them at one scale, and A appears to be more rich, more diverse than B. You measure them at a different scale, and it flips around. And this is all to do with the underlying complexities of different habitat types. So really, to me, there's a point where you get too hung up on trying to understand everything, and you're never going to really do that. And I think I'm rather pleased about that as an ecologist, because if we were fully able to do it, I'd be out of a job. So there is certainly something to be said from my perspective. But I do think that, you know, but the frameworks need to have a middle ground where they are fit for purpose, even though they'll never probably be completely perfect. I do worry a lot about these sort of fixations on neutrality, you know, carbon neutrality or biodiversity neutrality. So you're no net gain, you're no net loss, because as soon as you put something in that framework, you might be missing the bigger picture for what it's going. So you can have carbon neutral, but it's not be climate climate neutral. So we're looking at, we look at carbon mainly because we think of it from a climate change point of view. You have things which has no net change in carbon, but you've changed some other prominent greenhouse gas that's not a carbon compound, and you might have another knock-on effect there, and it's not climate neutral because you've just fixated on this very narrow window. The same goes with biodiversity loss. So I think there just needs to be a little bit of caution around using those approaches.
I wanted to talk about interdisciplinarity, one of those current buzzwords, but for natural capital, it seems very appropriate as an area, a field that requires a number of different disciplines, a number of different perspectives to give a full view. I asked each of the speakers, each of the panel members, how their work was interdisciplinary, if it was interdisciplinary.
I think it's very important, but I think it's something that you can't do quickly. I like doing interdisciplinary projects. I've basically done them for more than 25 years, and I've worked with a huge range of different people. But to do that and to do it well, you've got to have the time to build up the understanding and the kind of common language, if you like, between the research teams that you're working with. Rob and I both worked on this national project for DEFRA demonstration test catchments. Well, that's a real case in point because you had, you know, heavy-duty hydrologists and water chemists and people who were economists, people who were social scientists, someone like me somewhere in the middle, and we were dealing both with the sort of the water companies and we were dealing with farmers. To make the go of that kind of project, you've got to be able to sort of span those different languages. It's absolutely fundamental.
Yeah, I mean obviously the different versions of interdisciplinarity, and I've experienced a fair few versions in my time, and the one I particularly like is the idea of interdisciplinarity is sort of handing over stuff, and the knowledge changes as you go around through a process, and everyone can make different cuts of the same thing. There's this constant circulation of information. If you've got a framework or a venue in which information can pass around in different forms and ideas flow, then you've got quite a good basis for interdisciplinarity. Natural capital, and the problems natural capital is trying to solve, does need an interdisciplinary sort of perspective. I don't think it's the final word. I mean, there are some problems that make it inescapably problematical. So there's a kind of a limitation, there's an inbuilt limitation, which is probably why Alex so beautifully put it, it leads to sort of sensible science at the end of the day. So I think there are some limitations with it, but I think it's always been a good conversation starter. There is some element with these frameworks which you find yourself repeating the same debates 20 years on, and I start to become a bit of an old fogey. So are we still having this discussion? I thought we solved that like 15 years ago, and then you're back in it again.
Rob had to leave at that point in our discussions. And my final question to Alex and Andrew was about the future. Were they optimistic or pessimistic about the field?
I think I'm optimistic. You know, the research has come a long way. I was just sort of picking up on something Rob said, that, you know, every now and again we'll come back to something that we think, oh, I thought we solved that 10, 15 years ago. And I think that's one of those things that highlight the need for cross-disciplinary working, but also one of the risks with it, which is as soon as a new set of people from a different discipline come into an old topic, they start reading up on it and they start getting their head around it, and then they revisit some of the problems that you think you tucked away nicely. And normally when they come back out to the forefront again, it's because you didn't do as good a job as you thought you did in terms of tucking them away. And so I think we will continue go for a bit of a cycle of revisiting questions from the past, maybe until we absolutely fully say, right, we've got that completely nailed. But I think there's such a strong push from government, from the funders, from society in general, to really understand our natural world and the benefits it does to us. And I think a greater public perception that a loss of nature, and that is about as vague as it needs to be, is not a good thing. Not a good thing, and it is harming our ability to survive as a species. And that, to me, is something which I think the perception of that has increased, and it continues to increase year in, year out. And as long as that's there, I'm optimistic that we will continue to keep researching down this way, and we will start to come up with stronger and stronger solutions.
Yeah, I'm optimistic. There are lots of challenges, and we've touched on many of them. But I do think that there's enormous opportunities at the moment because of things that are coming through government through the Agriculture Act and the Environment Act, but changes that are taking place in the private sector, concerns about net zero, climate change, all these sorts of things. I am really struck in the last 5 years in the way in which the opportunities have arisen to work with coalitions of organisations on a scale of catchments or landscapes to start to try and address these issues. There are huge opportunities in that area. It means that what you're doing feels very real. People are interested in it, they're engaged in it, they want to know how they might be able to do things better. There's an opportunity to influence how things are done. And as an academic, I find that very interesting and I find it rather inspiring.
Earlier in the podcast, Alex described making the link between the natural world and services based upon it as unbelievably difficult. But we end with a sense of hope, optimism for the future, and a sense of inspiration about current research and the engagement of those who may benefit from it. It's been a long journey and our discussion has shown that there are still far to go, but there is progress and positivity in the field. My thanks to all three of today's speakers, Andrew Lovett from UEA, Alex Dumbrell from Essex, and Rob Fish from Kent. Thanks also to everyone who was involved in making this podcast, including Graham Harvey and Chris Martin of Purple Planet Music, who provided the theme tune. And thanks to you for listening. I hope you can join me again next time, when we continue to explore the furthest reaches of Eastern Arc.